it's what you do. The Strokes were in the middle of that debate. Yeah, yeah, yeahs. They're getting too big. They're selling out. And I just thought, to what? They're still doing exactly what they want to do. They have their own imprints on these giant labels and can do whatever the fuck they want to. What's cooler than that? I said, fucking do it. Do that car commercial. Who gives a fuck? It's going to go away in 6 months, and that money is going to float you for the next 2 years. Do it. I would. Then, over the course of 4 or 5 years, it all just disintegrated. And now it's the only way to make money. Dave Longstreth. In a world in which music is a democratically supported phenomenon, who's going to support it but the extreme rich and the corporate paymasters? There's no one else. James Barber. You do kind of have to separate from each other the idea of licensing versus being on a major label. They're parallel in issues, but they're not the same issue. Mark Spitz. Moby's Play was really the first album to thumb its nose at the very idea of selling out in the 90s sense. He ended up licensing every song on that album, and MTV and radio came around because of that and not vice versa. It came out at the very end of the decade, and was a kind of bridge to the new century. Gideon Yeago. I remember there was this ad guy who bought, I think it was, an Apples in Stereo song for Gap. They had just released a record, and they put a song in a Gap ad in 2000. And it was this song that got gossiped around in bars. I can't believe they sold the rights to their song for $40,000, $50,000, or $70,000. Sellout was the term you used, and you used it with great derision. Flash forward to 4 years later, or 5 years later. The music business is so annihilated, the indie rock labels are so annihilated. I mean, Yeah Yeah Yeahs were in a fucking Cadillac ad. That was unheard of. But these bands needed to survive. James Barber. The period you're talking about is at the end of the economic and cultural bubble. From the time the Beatles invented the album as a commercial concept, to the time when album sales just collapsed, there was an era, even up to the late 80s, early 90s, when you could make a living by making albums and making videos that got played on MTV, and not even really have to tour. You know, you could live in a house in the Hollywood Hills and make 3 hit singles and some videos, and play 100 shows and get wealthy. Paul Banks. I don't want to poo-poo it like it's bullshit, the whole selling out thing. I was bummed when I saw a Nirvana song on a commercial, because that was a really good song from Nevermind, and it was really important to me as a kid, and you don't use music that is that relevant to sell video games. But now things are different. Ryan Gentles. Getting Strokes t-shirts in Target was a really big deal. Transformers was about to come out, and Shia LaBeouf wears a Strokes t-shirt for much of the movie. The costume design lady asked her daughter, "Who's the coolest band?" And she said, "The Strokes." When the trailer started circulating, the reps from Target knew that it was going to be a hit, and it was a no-brainer. Target wants to sell Stroke shirts because Transformers is a big mega blockbuster and the kid is wearing a Stroke shirt. I did that deal. I sold 20,000 units to Target. It was a coup. It was amazing. Paul Banks. My policies have changed on where I'll license our music. Because fuck, man, I deserve to make a living too. So you can judge all you want about how we might license our song to a commercial, but start paying for the fucking CDs and I'll stop doing that. But the cool factor and the outsider thing really does speak to me. And I get that we represented a kind of counterculture, or a subculture, or an outsider culture. And then when you go really mainstream, that puts that illusion in jeopardy. I buy that. I can understand that. Ryan Gentles. I remember being 15, and I could buy a Nirvana t-shirt at Target. I thought it was awesome. It was, they sell Britney Spears here. They sell Christina Aguilera here. So other bands may think, that's not cool. I don't want to be sold next to those bands. But the Strokes were like, wouldn't it be cool if our kind of band were sold next to them? It would be like, yeah, we took over your fucking shit. That was the goal. It wasn't, we aren't going to sign to a major label, fuck major labels. No, it was, let's sign to a major label and flip the script on the music industry. So getting t-shirts into Target was a big thing. Moby. Now you could reach your audience more directly. In the 80s and 90s, there were 5 outlets. There was Spin, Rolling Stone, MTV, VH1, and alternative rock radio. And if you didn't have the support of those 5 things, your label was going to drop you, and no one would hear your records. Suddenly, with the internet, people could reach people directly, bypass the gatekeepers, and have almost, in a weird way, a more authentic experience. The art was more authentic, and the relationship the artists had with the audience was more authentic. Personally, I think very much the internet has benefited music, because there's less profit motive. So I think that people have no incentive to compromise. Dave Gottlieb. What's changed is advertising has got better. That's what made it more palatable for artists to say yes. Advertising got better. It's Apple, it's VW. Putting ELO in a VW ad the way they did, it changes it. The platform got better, and I think that artists got a lot pickier about saying, all right, you want to use my song? I get to be involved in the creative. I'm not saying yes until I see the ad. Casey Spooner. NME would always deride me, saying the only thing that was ever important to me was whether we had a good picture or not. But now look at the world we live in. We live in a world of Kardashians. All you have to do to be important is look hot and make amateur porn. It's entirely about image now. And the reason corporate sponsors partner with people who look hot, who take a good picture, is for exposure, is for traffic. Someone has made a logarithm out of our behavior, and they're profiting from it. That's why Red Bull can give an artist X amount of dollars or give them ad space. They can invest because what they're going to get back in terms of exposure is advertising. It's all advertising. We're all advertisers now. We're all monetized. Mark Spitz. Licensing became the new radio. iPod commercials became the new TRL. Andy Greenwald. The story of the last 15 years is the story of the abdication of struggle. And it's good and bad in ways that are legitimate, in ways that are just nostalgic. Like the struggle of finding the record, literally finding the band, going to the record store, hearing the recommendation from your friend's older brother or sister, or whatever. That's gone. Gone forever. And I have nostalgia for that, certainly. But the other part of the struggle that I just inherited, and never really questioned, was this idea of all the old 90s struggles of success. I remember Vampire Weekend basically telling me, yeah, we got a tour bus and it's great. And I was, you know, judging them for that. But of course it's great. There's a fucking bathroom in it. If you can afford it, you should get a tour bus by all means. But I was still carrying baggage. Baggage that they didn't have. Those battles of authenticity and credibility and selling out, those battles completely went away. The marketplace that Vampire Weekend went into was completely different from the one that even the Strokes went into. The Strokes and all those bands were the last time the major label machine tried to get its rusty bones together and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do one more scene, and we're all going to get rich and do a lot of blow. But none of those scenes got them over the hump, and then they still all collapsed. Chris Thompson. Our music is in a very post-genre world. I feel like kids won't go to the mat for one genre or another now. Whereas someone in the 90s with a Sonic Youth t-shirt would be like, fuck you! This is my thing! This is what I listen to! Now it's like, oh cool, you like Sonic Youth? Have you heard the Harlem Shakes? You get picked on because your Twitter humor is bad, not because you like the wrong records. Chapter 74. We could be that big.
Karen O. To be a band coming up in a real fucking moment, there's no question that it baptized us as special. Just being able to evolve and somehow not lose all our fans. Taking our time. For us, being in the shadow preserved us. I wonder, for the Strokes, if it was a massive disadvantage to be first and to be so huge. Jenny Eliskew. There are very few examples, Green Day being one of them, but very few examples of something that was genuinely underground that ever made it that big. Because if you're genuinely underground, you're going to take risks that don't pay off. You're going to make music that's deliberately abrasive and impossible to listen to, like Julian Casablancas has done. If you're a real artist, you know what I mean?
Mark Spitz. Julian seemed like a different person when I met him for the third album Cover Story. He was with Juliet, who is now his wife, and he was sober. They were living in Juliet's little apartment, and he seemed happy. He seemed like he was making music that he was really proud of. But nobody liked that record. So basically what Julian likes is what Julian likes, and what everyone else thinks is great makes him miserable. Gordon Raphael. There was one thing on Julian's mind all the time. How can a band be cool and still sell? Just that short phrase was in his mind and on his lips. How can a band be cool and still sell? Nick Valenci. We had conversations that went along the lines of, gosh, I think our songs are better than Mr. Brightside by the Killers, but how come that's the one everyone is listening to? They did it a different way. They recorded it in a different way. They promoted it in a different way. We could be that big. Gordon Raphael. Julian would tell me, Gordon, all these fans came after us and kind of took some of my ideas and now they're selling a lot more. When I hear my songs from Room on Fire come on, and then I hear Franz Ferdinand or I hear the White Stripes, their music sounds so much bigger. What can we do to make our music sound that big? I flew over for a special meeting with the band. They said, I want you to build us a studio in our practice room. You'll be in charge, so we won't feel any time constraints. So I designed and built them a studio in the practice room. Then I went there after the tour in June of 2004, and they had no songs prepared. Ryan Gentles. Julian can't write on the road. That's the problem. That's why he never wants to tour. Mark Spitz. It's not heavy lifting, and it's not working in a slaughterhouse, you know? It's not going to war, but you do have to have a certain wiring. Ryan Gentles. He said it destroys him. He can't write. He can't think. He tells me when I talk about touring, I know you're going to think I'm crazy. I know you're going to think this sounds nuts, but I'm just barely getting over the tour from 2 years ago. Julian Casablancas. I consider the main thing that I do writing, working on music. When you go on a tour for a lot of time, that gets taken away. Ryan Gentles. And I say to him, that does sound crazy and nuts. It was fucking 2.5 years ago. Julian says, that's how badly it fucks me up, mentally and physically. I'm like, dude, this is our entire livelihood. If you don't have thicker skin than that, we're fucked. I can't do it. I can't write. I'm not creative. I get depressed. I come home. I'm under a pile of shit. I'm trying to dig myself out. Then I can't write at home because I'm catching up. Julian Casablancas. We had toured for so long, I felt like I had to almost start over musically, which was a real bummer. And I promised myself that I wouldn't do that ever again. Ryan Gentles. It's real hard to argue with someone when you're saying, we need to do this tour, we need to do this show, it's going to be good for your career. And he's saying, okay, I'll do that, then we're going to break up, because I'm going to want to kill myself. Or we don't do it, and at least we'll have a career next year. I'm forced to say, okay, I choose the career next year. Albert Hammond Jr. At the beginning of recording First Impressions, that's when the solo stuff started. Gordon Raphael. One day, Albert came up to me in the studio and says, I've been hanging out with my best friend, Julian Lennon, and he is making a solo album, and they're working with this engineer named David Kahn. So you think when we start the album that we can just use this guy to get some cool sounds? My thought was, I don't mind if that's what the band wants. Julian Casablancas. Yeah, it was tricky. We were hoping Gordon and David would get along and get the best of both worlds, but it became Battle of the Producers. We were sounding different, which I think some people wanted, so we just saw it through with David. Gordon Raphael. After Christmas break, I came back to start the Strokes record, and on the fifth day, they had a meeting. Julian took me for a cup of soup. Hey, we want to record with David Kahn. Do you mind if you don't record this album? Mark Spitz. That record's just a big rock record. I mean, the guy who made it made that Outfield song Your Love. He made Walk Like an Egyptian. Jim Merlis. I like half of the third album, and the songs I like I think are maybe their best songs. But then I get the feeling they were making a record just to be different than the other records, and that doesn't work. Albert Hammond Jr. With Room on Fire, people were giving us shit because they said we were sounding too much the same. With the third album, we were getting shit that we don't sound like Room on Fire. I feel like I got fucked by the same thing twice. Jim Merlis. There was bad stuff going on with the band. A lot of fighting, arguing, and the shows were bad. They were really, really drunk. It just wasn't fun. Everything was becoming a bummer. They didn't want to tour. They didn't want to do anything. It was just not fun to be around them anymore. Dave Gottlieb. Go back to when I said to the band, "What's your vision?" And they couldn't answer that question. They had that vision on the first 8 months of the first album, and then they stopped. Probably because the roller coaster was so crazy. They just couldn't see. Mark Spitz. They seemed a lot older, a lot older. And it had only been like 2 years. They looked older. And they seemed defeated in a weird way. And impatient. Like they just wanted it to be over, you know? Fab was doing things like showing up for a remixing session in a Darth Vader mask. They each had their own perspective on life at that point. I had a sense of them knowing the game. They were trying to convince me it was a unit. They were not deluded that maybe it was over. Their moment was over. They were very wised up, and sober and older. Just older. Not sober as in not drinking. Albert was most definitely not sober. Nikolai was not sober. I did the interview with Albert in a bar. I did the interview with Julian in his apartment. I did the interview with Nick over lunch. And I did the interview with Fab in the rehearsal space. And then Drew Barrymore met him and they said, "We're gonna go have sex now." And I went home. Albert Hammond Jr. That's probably the first time I noticed it had stopped being fun, the recording of First Impressions. That's when things started getting into the gap. Friends, girlfriends, people who worked with us, other people, strangers would all just start coming in being like, "You should be a bigger band." And I was like, "Yeah, we should be a bigger band." For as strong as we were, and as close as we weren't close or strong enough to fight it. Fabrizio Moretti. That's the house of cards that is being in the Strokes. There was a lot of emotions that were kept secret, but were so evident. We didn't know how to process them. A, because we were children, and B, because it's hard to process subliminal, subconscious, volcanic emotions. We were kids that wanted to conquer the world, but we had no idea that we were going to be given the chance to. We had been, like, physically primed for some kind of release that we didn't know was coming, necessarily. And that tension, the fact that friendships could form in little cliques and stuff, meant that everybody felt like an outsider. Steven Trachtenbreit. Jules doesn't let anybody else speak their mind, and I feel like a lot of resentment comes from that, especially moving forward after Room on Fire. Ryan Adams. I don't think that meeting I had with the guys ever was about heroin. I think it was about jealousy. And I think that maybe the idea was that this world they were in was slipping out of their hands. And maybe Julian felt like it was slipping out of his control. Mark Spitz. Julian would have liked to have been more of a Beck figure, you know? Where he could work with Nigel Godrich. He could work with the Dust Brothers. He could make his own Serge Gainsbourg, Histoire du Melody Nelson or something. Stephen Trachtenbreuth. Julian got what he wanted. He wanted to be the next Guided by Voices. He's capable of writing those big hit songs, but he won't let it get that far. He's really creative. He has all of these ideas. He's a great songwriter. But he stops himself, or won't play the game to get further. Mark Spitz. Even when Spin made the Strokes Band of the Year after the Is This It tour, it was already starting. I mean, they played like they believed on stage. They went out there to kill every fucking night. I still haven't seen a better band. I didn't see The Clash, but it was like what you imagine they were like. They came out and punched the audience in the fucking mouth every night. You went home with stars spinning around your head. But I remember Nick saying, even then, man, this is all bullshit. Like, we're not even Band of the Year. We shouldn't be here. The White Stripes are Band of the Year. They didn't want to own it, you know? Dave Gottlieb. One of the detriments of the Strokes being from New York is that they're savvy. You always have to have an answer for everything. If you're a couple kids from rural Tennessee and your father is a whacked-out preacher, and you have this opportunity, well, yeah, you're going to listen. If you're Brandon Flowers and you're from a Mormon family and you're in fucking Las Vegas, you're going to listen. Caleb Followill. At the heart of it, the Strokes don't take shit. At all. I've gotten into fights with them. I've been on their side and had to fight other people. We've done lots of crazy shit together. They don't ever compromise. They don't ever want anyone to tell them what they should do or what they shouldn't do. And that's a part of who they are. Julian Casablancas. My biggest regret in general is that I drank so much. I warded off any kind of intense introspection. We never really had those moments where we're all cheering in a freeze frame, credits roll. If anything, not to be dark and foreshadowing about the things that hurt the band, but I think if anything, it was always a sense of like, we're not doing the right thing. We're not... It was always, why are we... I don't know. Mark Spitz. Julian was a perfectionist. And you saw Jack White was too. But something about the whole thing sat better with Jack. He acted more like a rock star. He crashed his car. He dated Renee Zellweger. He punched out that guy from the Von Bondies. He seemed more suited to act out that role. Maybe because instinctively he knew that he would survive. I don't know. His vision seems pretty strong. And Jack didn't have the burden of New York City. Jack White. Sometimes being thrust out there immediately pushes you to hurry up and figure yourself out and do away with years of fumbling. That happened to the Strokes. They had to get it together fast, and it worked for them. Meg and I had 3 albums out and an almost too realistic view that nobody was ever going to care about our music. We were already assuming we had a life of playing in bars for 30 people in our future. So the extra time to get our things together was good for us mentally. It still shocks me that the mainstream accepted that music. It doesn't add up. Julian Casablancas. We became as big as you can become while still staying under the radar, which is amazing and maybe ideal. But it was never this big breakthrough, you know what I'm saying? There was never this MC Hammer moment where you're like, there's so much money, the success is gonna last forever, and then you squander it. To us, it always felt amazing, but like it could disappear at any second. Or it wasn't that huge. Ronnie Vannucci. It's such a weird profession. It could really warp you or make you into something cool. But it's kind of down to luck which way it all plays out. Austin Skaggs. I saw the Strokes bubble burst when I went to South America and Brazil for a bunch of shows with Kings of Leon and Arcade Fire and the Strokes. It wasn't for Rolling Stone. I just wanted to go. I was like, Ryan, I'll take the video camera. I'll document this trip. I'll just shoot everything, and you can have whatever you want. I'll pay for my own ticket. Honestly, I was thinking it was going to be like Led Zeppelin. Like you walk into the room and there's a bed full of women. I thought it was going to be a giant, debaucherous orgy of booze and drugs. It was the absolute opposite. To be super blunt about it, the Strokes were crumbling right in front of my eyes, right in front of the camera. There was a lot of resentment, and there was a lot of tension. We would have a lobby call at like 9 in the morning to go to a rehearsal or to go get a plane, and it would be 11:30 and nobody was there. These are things that don't happen. I remember driving an hour and a half to some rehearsal space before these big festival shows that they were doing, and they never played a note. They ended up having a very big, serious band meeting when this rehearsal was supposed to take place. They didn't let me in, even as a fly on the wall. It was so intense. It wasn't even really drugs that I remember. It was more like everyone was just sick of each other. Obviously, Julian was resentful of everyone putting out solo records and not contributing to the Strokes records. It was a power trip. When I got home, I was like, wow, that was not what I expected. I didn't see one naked girl the whole time.
Kelly Kiley. They were all best men at Julian's wedding, and I think that might be the last time I saw them all together as that gang.
Ryan Gentles. When I found out Julian and Juliet were dating, I was so mad. I was like, what are you doing? You can't fuck the lead singer. I can't have my assistant fuck my boss. I said, you can date him and quit, or you can have the job and stay. What do you want to do? And she just said, no, nothing's happening. And I said, good. Get your head out of your fucking ass. You're being an idiot. She kept it a secret for a long time. Nick Valenci. People knew that they liked each other, and they'd have flings. It was normal and fine. Ryan Gentles. How did I find out about it? Back in the day, she'd come on tour with us if I needed an assistant, and she'd share a room with me. She was my buddy. It was no big deal. I woke up to Julian making out with Juliet in my room, and I just left the room. I was like, this is bullshit. What the fuck was that? They were both shit-faced. Nick Valenci. She was our assistant manager. She was an amazing person. She's an awesome, awesome woman. She was really instrumental in us getting to where we got to at that point. I'd be lying if I didn't admit that when they announced they were getting married, I was kind of like, okay, what does this mean now for this kind of managerial relationship that we have? But that wasn't a concern, so much as a logistical question. How is this going to work? I was surprised that they were engaged to be married, and I was super fucking happy for them. I love the both of them. And you know what? They fucking love each other so much. David Cross. Juliet's awesome. She grew up on a farm in Connecticut, and you'd never guess that about her. She's tough, smart, sensible, allows Julian to be Julian. They're perfect together. Albert Hammond Jr. After I moved in with Catherine and he moved in with Juliet, we just didn't hang out the same way anymore. I missed his energy. I got sad. I felt a distance between us. That was a big part for me in this band, just hanging out with him, just being friends with him. We lived together for 7 years. I've never lived with a girl that long. Julian Casablancas. Does that mean anything to me? I mean, of course. The way I remember it, we were roommates, and we moved places, and I wanted to stay roommates, and I feel like maybe he was not so into it anymore. Albert, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, baby. Ryan Gentles. Julian told me that if he ever felt like being fucked up was going to get in the way of the music, that he'd cut it out. One day he decided, during First Impressions of Earth, that he had a real bad session, and he trashed the studio. He realized the next day that he had trashed it out of frustration, because he couldn't find the lyrics, and he realized it was because he was hungover. He realized it was getting in the way of music. Julian Casablancas. I couldn't really function without drinking. That's a problem. I just got sloppy. It was bad. Ryan Gentles. He quit smoking, drinking, and doing drugs all on the same day without a program or anything, and never looked back, never had a falter. That's a man of will. Harmar Superstar. Julian got his shit together. When he got sober, it was really good. I didn't see him for years. He was just drying out and being normal and getting into sports, which is awesome. Ryan Gentles. He was a drunken nightmare to society as a whole, let alone the people he worked with. The people he worked with got it the worst, but it was society as a whole. He got sober, and it was awesome. So did his wife with him. Isn't that amazing? They're still together, and they're fucking rad. Albert Hammond Jr. During the recording of our third record, I was just sad. I had a very easy ability to spiral. There could be all this amazing stuff happening to me, and within 2 minutes I could convince myself why there's no reason to live. That kind of thing. That extreme. Matt Romano. When they were shooting with Dan Winters for First Impressions, and Albert came to the shoot and he was fucked up, things changed. Albert Hammond Jr. At that point, I'd come in and the band would think, why is he so moody and bummed out? It was also Catherine and me. Why aren't we having sex anymore? Because I'm fucking my drugs. You don't want to have sex when you do those drugs, and you really can't. To come is like a pain in the ass. It's like a job. You have to plan it out. I know she's gonna want to have sex tonight. Fuck.
Catherine Pierce. He confessed to me that he had been doing heroin. I knew something was wrong. He always told me it was pills. He was gone more and more. I didn't know what was happening. He'd come home and he seemed different. He'd say he was exhausted from tour. I'm exhausted from tour, so I'm gonna sleep for days. But I'm the kind of person who believes what I'm told. If someone I love is promising me something, I believe it, to a point. I think I was scared to leave him, too. I didn't know what my life would be like. I didn't know who would remain my friend. So he confessed to me that he was a heroin addict. He'd been snorting. And I stuck with him. He went through rehab, and things got better for a while.
Albert Hammond Jr. It wasn't until we got back from Japan in 2007. That's when I started shooting up. I'd just do it when we were home.
Catherine Pierce. It just started creeping back in. It's okay if I smoke a little pot. It's okay if I take some pills. And it just started back up again. Kim Taylor Bennett. During what would stretch to a 5+ year gap between the release of First Impressions of Earth and The Strokes' fourth record, Angles, Albert released 2 solo albums and toured the world with Matt Romano in his band.
Matt Romano. Albert sets out to do something, and he wants to be the best at it. If he wants to fucking be a junkie, he's going to be the best junkie out there. And he also has a very romantic outlook on it, like, all of my favorite people and influences had their junk phase.
Catherine Pierce. We were at a friend's wedding, and he promised me he would not do drugs. He'd make all these ridiculous promises. If I do drugs again, I'll buy you. And I'd say, okay. Not because I wanted a pony, but because I wanted to believe him. But he couldn't help himself, and the wedding was just a disaster. The night before the wedding, a group of them were downstairs doing drugs until 5 in the morning. We had to get up and do wedding day preparations the next day, and I was just so heartbroken. That was it. I was done. You know when you're done, and I knew. He started dating someone else, and then he got really deep into heroin.
Albert Hammond Jr. At the time, I tried everything to get fired from the band. I'd show up late, fall asleep at the studio. I was just fucked up. I didn't like things. I tried to help out, but I wasn't playing that well. I wasn't at my peak of playing. Julian Casablancas. Did we ever consider replacing Albert? I don't know how to answer that. I don't want to start shit. I'll say this. It was never an option for me. Matt Romano. You know, Albert also had a very healthy competition with Julian. It was always, I want to beat the Strokes. Albert Hammond Jr. I finished the First Impressions tour, and then I went on a 9-month solo tour and did 128 shows, detoxing on the road. I didn't really think of what I had done as an album. I was literally going to put it out online or something like that. I wasn't even going to do any shows. It was Matt who kept saying, "We have to do some shows." And I said, "Matt, I don't want to play shows." He pushed. "Oh, let's do these three." And it turned into 128 shows in 9 months. Matt Romano. After touring Yours to Keep and in between making Como Te Llamo, that's when the Crossroads thing happened. He would always talk about, if I were ever going to go to rehab, I would want to go to Crossroads. You know, Clapton's place in Antigua. So I get him a bed there. This was me, Julian, Albert's parents, and Albert's then-girlfriend, Lisa. It was awful. He was so mad at me. He said the meanest things to me. He made me cry. He didn't end up going to Crossroads. Albert Hammond Jr. I finally had a breakdown at the end of finishing the second solo record. I said to myself, okay, that's it. I'm done with doing drugs. And I did get clean for a while, 8 months or something like that. Then I started doing it again. I got back into it. I was like, I'm not going to do heroin. I started drinking and sniffing a little coke on the weekend. As long as I don't do heroin, I'll dull my pain in some way, but I'm not doing heroin. So I started shooting cocaine and ketamine. Weirdly, I thought, that's okay, because I'm not doing heroin. I was making my own crack. The ketamine I would just shoot. I was shooting it intravenously, 20 times a day. Everything was black and blue. Matt Romano. That was so scary. Albert Hammond Jr. It was scary for them, not for me. They saw me in a pretty extreme place. When you puncture yourself constantly, your arms are destroyed. When they catch you out of it, you are seriously out of it. You are like retarded. Sometimes, when you're sniffing, it's like that. But it's very different when you're shooting cocaine and ketamine and then heroin and cocaine. Sometimes I could be sitting here with my eyes open, just gone. Matt Romano. He was just a different person. Albert Hammond Jr. There were so many times when I was just so close to dying, where my body was shaking. I heard voices. I stayed up for 90-something hours. I'd be in the shower and hear whole conversations, or I'd spend hours looking out the people, thinking I could hear someone walking up. Crazy stuff. Ryan Gentles. They were never broken up. They never talked about not making another record. 5 years was just Albert wanted to release some music, and Julian wanted to release some music, and Nikolai wanted to release some, and Fab did some. It wasn't really planned to go that long, it was just, I need a few more months. Now I want to put out a record. I think that caused them to think, couldn't you have done that when I was doing my record? It was all ill-timed, and they would disagree on when they'd get back together. Julian Casablancas. That was transition time. I mean, I put so much of my energy, life, blood, sweat, and tears into the band. And to be honest, it took me a while to recover from drinking. It took years to get normal. I started young, so I was kind of starting over. Matt Romano. Albert was supposed to be a guest judge on Iron Chef. I was supposed to go with him for his walkthrough of the studio, and he wasn't answering his phone. He wanted to do this for so long because he's a total foodie. Juliet calls me and she's like, "What the fuck is going on? There's no way he would miss this." She was mad. She said, "Tell me right now what the fuck is happening." So she knew something was up. I told her, "Listen, I've been trying to help him on my own, and I can't do it anymore." She said, "Okay, I'm calling Julian." I'm like, "No, no, not Julian." She calls Julian. Julian calls me. We talk, and immediately he says, "All right, I'm calling Albert Sr." Albert Hammond Jr. I went through a downward spiral. We met up to start writing Angles in 2009. And then I just hit the lowest point in June, July, and August. Everyone came out to record at my house upstate, and I was fucked. I went to go pick up Nikolai, and I bought truckloads of candy, and I was late. I was crazy. Everyone knew. Oh, Albert's definitely high. And then 2 days later, they came up and said, "You have to go." Not all of them. Julian didn't come up. But my mom was there, and so the choice was that basically everyone would forgive me if I went to the 3 months of rehab. So I did. In L.A., a month in a detox place, and 2 months in sober living.
Catherine Pierce. We are really good friends now, but it took a few years. There was a moment when we hated each other. Then I had a dream about him. I had a dream that he was at the top of a building and that he was going to jump off, and I was pleading with him, "Don't jump," and he was saying, "I have to," and he jumped off. And the next day, I read somewhere that he went to rehab, again. I wrote to him, and then we started confiding in each other and talking about new loves. Now we have a really nice relationship. I know him so well. It's in such a different way now. We've talked about it. He says, "I'm so sorry I was a drug addict," and I say, "I'm so sorry I was trying to stop you and control you."
Albert Hammond Jr. I'm sorry I killed everyone's dreams. I don't know if they're still mad at me. We'd worked so hard and we'd gotten so good. We were just like a machine. A well-oiled machine. Even when we sucked, we were awesome. We were emotionally disconnected. But physically and musically, what we built was at its peak. Chapter 75. Breezier and lighter and quicker. Simon Reynolds. Bands always come about through some mesh of individual quirks. In the 90s, it was still more organic, how that happened, more happenstance. So there was a degree of limitation. But now it's almost like every musician growing up is exposed to so much music that they can just assemble themselves in an almost mechanical way. That's why Vampire Weekend have all these unusual rhythms from different cultures. It's a really, really wide smorgasbord. Young musicians are just exposed to so much stuff now, from very early on, that their whole relationship with music is different. Ryan Gentles. Jenny Eliscu was the one who first told me about this band, Vampire Weekend.
Jenny Eliscu. I had heard about them through a friend who went to Columbia with them.
Ryan Gentles. They were the next thing, for sure.
Jenny Eliscu. I told them they reminded me of the Strokes, and they said, "We love the Strokes." They were in high school when Is This It came out. They wanted to be the Strokes in a way, but they were smarter about it.
Steve Ralbovsky. There was a uniformity of musical inspiration that characterized a lot of the downtown New York bands at the time, as well as the White Stripes and Kings of Leon. It was more of a rock and roll thing. Vampire Weekend was quirky and folky and had these African rhythms, lyrics that were kind of dreamy, whimsical, kooky, and non-narrative. Ezra had a voice that didn't suffer from irony, angst, and heaviness, that minor chord rock and roll stuff. It was a breath of fresh air. And maybe it wasn't intended as a breath of fresh air, but whatever the music was that was going on in their heads at the time, they provided a different, lighter, more buoyant, less heavy alternative, while still belonging to a common aesthetic. Sort of like the way Talking Heads in the beginning were this quirky folk rocky band that were around at the same time as the Ramones. It was aesthetically compatible, but musically much breezier and lighter and quirkier. Chris Thompson. The Strokes have been one of our touchstones for when we've made decisions about career stuff. But when we came out, the Strokes were on hiatus. It just kind of seemed like, oh, they had a tough time. Or they did really well, but somehow something about their career got annoying.
Jenny Eliscu. Vampire Weekend learned from the Strokes' mistakes in an important way. They were college kids and very bright, and they seemed, just generally speaking, to be more grounded people. Much less sensitive in a way. That, I think, is often the difference between artists who can really keep it going and those who can't.
Ezra Koenig. I grew up in New Jersey, 30 minutes away on the train, definitely the burbs. Rostambot Mongolish. I'm from D.C. originally. Chris Thompson. I don't know if you've ever been to Great Adventure Six Flags in New Jersey. I grew up like 5 minutes from there. I was a lifeguard at the water park there for a summer. Chris Bayo. I grew up in Westchester, New York. Ezra Koenig. I was a massive music fan and collector as a teenager. I would buy a shitload of records at yard sales, and I got deep into my parents' record collection. In the middle of high school, I started hanging out with a group of kids who were really into early 90s hip-hop, The Roots and Tribe Called Quest, also DJ Shadow and trip-hop, these kinds of things. My other main interest was punk. My dad had the first few Clash albums, Blondie and the Ramones, and I had another tight group of friends that were really into that stuff.
Jenny Eliscu. Vampire Weekend are a band of guys who went to college, like Pavement or the Talking Heads, and the Strokes are guys who didn't go to college. They were middle class, actually sort of upper middle class. Not as rich as the Strokes, but comfortable.
Andy Greenwald. That's always the third rail of writing about bands. Because if you wanted to bring it to that realm, there is the part that Ezra and Rostam came from quite upper class Ivy League backgrounds, and probably would not go hungry if they decided to do other things. Chris Thompson. What really fascinated me about Ezra early on was that he had this blog called Internet Vibes. There was one ad for an early Vampire Weekend show on there, where he put a picture of Derek Walcott. He used a picture of an African-American writer to promote a Vampire Weekend show. The things he was interested in seemed a little bit more sophisticated than the shit that I was interested in. Ezra Koenig. My dad was really up on good new music right until I was born. The last new album he had was the first Run-DMC album, which came out in 1984, the year I was born. I'm glad that my parents more or less stopped listening to new music, that we listened to old stuff, rather than them slowly morphing into listening to parent-type music. Rostambot Mongolish. I actually wanted to be a painter when I was a kid. I was sure that I was going to go to Cooper Union. Brian Eno was studying to be a painter. He said that recording music is like being able to paint with sound, like a graphical interaction, especially on the computer. I must have been about 14 when I started making music on the computer, but I started writing melodies when I was really young, like 6. I had a really cool guitar teacher, and he said, "You can learn whatever you want. What do you want to learn?" I wanted to learn High and Dry by Radiohead. I wanted to learn Mr. Jones by the Counting Crows. And that was the beginning. I have memories of trying to play Wonderwall for hours and not being able to make my fingers stick. At some point, I decided, I don't want to learn guitar anymore. Just teach me music theory. By the time I was 18, I felt like I knew pretty much everything I wanted to know about guitar. But with music theory, there was more of a code that I wanted to see unlocked before my eyes. Ezra Koenig. I wrote for my school newspaper. I'd write music articles, which is hilarious, because my school was so small. You'd write an article in the paper, and you might as well go directly to the one person who's going to read it and tell them what you had to say. Chris Bayo. I had an awareness of what CBGB was. I went to CBGB when I was 17. It was to see a Good Charlotte show, because my little sister was obsessed with Good Charlotte. Ezra Koenig. I remember I really bonded with one of the gym teachers, because I wrote something about Bruce Springsteen, and he became my buddy after that. He burned me a White Stripes CD. Chris Bale. I was 16 when the first Strokes record came out. I remember a friend saying, "Oh, the Strokes are a bunch of rich kids." Which is funny in two ways, because I was growing up in Westchester and my parents are lawyers. And I thought, okay, yeah, I won't listen. And then 8 years later, when our band came out, that was all that anyone said about us. So maybe there was some karmic justice in that. Chris Thompson. Growing up in suburban Jersey, right between New York and Philly, I'd heard of the Strokes mainly because they were on MTV. I knew, like, Leather Jacket, Downtown New York, probably drinking a bunch. Ezra Koenig. I also wrote an article about the connections between punk and hip-hop. I don't think I had some particularly interesting insight, but it was very obvious to me, based on the records that my dad had, Blondie and Grandmaster Flash using Tom Tom Club. So my vision of punk was already more like the arty downtown New York variant than vegan hardcore shit. And The Clash, too, who straight up made hip-hop. It seemed like it was more or less the same thing, which was this kind of open-minded approach toward references. And then, of course, I loved the Beastie Boys. Already at that point, there was that 90s kids vibe of skateboarders who listened to Ice Cube and some kind of weird guitar music. That was normal. Imran Ahmed. There's quite a big gap between the first group of kids in bands and the kids that followed, because they pretty much always had the internet. They grew up with AOL. That's quite a big, not philosophical, but there's a fundamental gap there. These guys, their generation, they were the first to be given these tools, the internet, mobile phones. They were the first generation to be given these tools as teenagers. And they came to grips with them really quickly. Ezra Koenig. I was about to go to college. I wasn't really thinking about how do I get in the music game. But we had this band that would meet up at my and my friend's house, and we'd record stuff. We'd make shit that sounded like Mogwai. Then we'd make weird punk songs, make rap songs. I remember when The Strokes came out, we'd obsessively play Someday. We just loved that song. Chris Bale. When I moved into the city, that was when Room on Fire came out. That was my first semester of college. I got both Strokes records then, and got really into them at the same time I got into the first Interpol record. Rostam Batmanghelidj. I did have a crush on New York. Ezra Koenig. I was pretty into New York City. It's where I was born, it's where my family comes from. So I always had a slight sense of having been taken away from the place I belong, which is how I think my dad always felt. He was born and raised in the Bronx, and lived in Manhattan his whole young adult life. So I think for him, moving to the suburbs was awkward. That probably rubbed off on me a little bit. I always had this sense that the city was where I belonged. Rostam Batmanghelidj. I think it was because my parents took me to see Basquiat when I was 11. That fucked me up real good. It made me look at New York as this place of infinite possibility. Chris Bale. I'd go to the Bowery, I'd go to Mercury Lounge. I remember going to see Interpol at Radio City in 2005. Chris Thompson. I saw Antibalas in 2001 at this Jewish community cultural thing. I just remember that flipped me out. That was when the internet was coming into play. I read about them on their website. And then I was able to go to the Princeton Record Exchange and get Antibalas and Fela Kuti the Tuesday after I got back. That was the first time I remember, like, using the internet for that specific purpose. Seeing this thing randomly, being totally blown away, and then being able to go read about it. Ezra Koenig. A lot of times, the critics or journalists want a story that's about a band making a new album, and they discovered something. Like they went into a record store and found this album they couldn't stop listening to. Or they were traveling and they got inspired. That's a classic story. I was traveling somewhere and the music in India or New Orleans really took me into a new place. I don't think this is a brag in the internet era, but by the time I was 18, I probably had a rough familiarity with just about every type of pop music internationally. So there wasn't that much left to blow my mind. That is what it is to be a music fan these days. You grow up surrounded by everything. So every album you make is not so much about finding new things. It's about dismissing things and actually zeroing in on what you think is cool at the moment. You can always rediscover things and recontextualize things. Chris Thompson. When Vampire Weekend started, specifically a lot of what we did was in opposition to the Mercury Lounge sound. Ezra Koenig. No disco beat, no post-Strokes beat. Even though we were all massive Strokes fans, we recognized how many shitty bands had tried to copy them. So it felt really important to find a new kind of guitar identity and rhythmic drum identity. Chris Thompson. The Mercury Lounge was the place where a band, even of our small stature, could play first. But also, the place sticks in my mind because it's where Ryan Gentles met the Strokes. It's an important place in modern rock history. But the Strokes' sound was sort of over. So one of the explicit goals was, we don't want to sound anything like that. Chapter 76. Erudite as fuck. Ezra Koenig. I always had a fairly pragmatic streak that made me not ever fully commit to the dream, which is an ongoing issue. I think it's important to always feel like you're doing music as a hobby, because if you start looking at it as a job, you start making terrible decisions. I like the idea of it as a serious hobby, because if you start taking it for granted that it's your job and you get to do it for a long time, you go on tour and it's like, oh, nice. We came back to this city and the show got bigger. We got paid more money for that thing. Our song was in that movie. I met this person. It starts to feel effortless. And you forget that all of this cool stuff that happens to you is predicated on this weird, tumultuous, fickle, creative energy that doesn't care about money or status. If you start to act like, yeah, I'm a musician, I'll be doing this in 10 years, I think that's poisonous. Imran Ahmed. You could say that the Arctic Monkeys formed a band because of the Vines, for example. But I never got the sense that Vampire Weekend formed a band because of the Strokes or anyone else. They definitely knew their music, they were definitely very passionate about music and very knowledgeable. But they didn't sign up to be guitar heroes.
Jenny Eliskew. Ezra, one of his principal gifts is being all-around erudite as fuck, you know? And that will serve him in everything he does for the rest of his very successful and interesting life, I'm sure. He's definitely no Julian, you know? Alex Wagner. Come on. Ezra is not Julian, right? They are not the same. They are not battling the same demons. Constitutionally, they're different people. I mean, there's this very reasonable millennial idea of your art form as a fundamentally manageable thing. Like, you could go and be an artist, as opposed to you can't be anything but an artist and it's this all-encompassing demon you have to wrestle with. There's just a completely different attitude about the musical output between the generations. The millennials are more practically minded for sure.
Ezra Koenig. I thought I might major in evolutionary biology. I didn't know what I was going to do. Rostam Batmanglish. I pictured myself coming to New York and forming a band, but I didn't know exactly what that looked like. Chris Thompson. There was a weekend in the middle of the summer before classes started, where there was this one-hour talk of all the kids that lived in the area that were going to Columbia. The shtick was you got a free copy of The Odyssey, which you were supposed to read over the summer. I don't remember this, but Ezra remembers seeing me. He thought I seemed kind of chill, probably like drugs, which I didn't and still don't. I did have longer hair. Ezra Koenig. Rostam and I knew people in common, and once we had our first real conversation, we were talking about making music. Rostam Batmanglish. The first time we hung out at a party, we talked about starting a band together, half-jokingly. Ezra Koenig. He told me his favorite band was Coldplay. Rostam Batmanglish. We used to IM each other MP3s of stuff. Ezra Koenig. He felt like he really didn't know what he was doing yet, musically. Rostam Batmanglish. Throughout college, I was recording these, I guess they were covers? They were just my version of a song by one of my favorite bands. One was a cover of Prince's I Would Die For You, which I literally recreated every drum part, every synth part, and sang every vocal part, even the three-part harmony in the second verse. I was thinking about the ingredients that go into a recipe and how you cook them. Ezra Koenig. The stuff he'd play me would be very referential and would sound like The Strokes or Walkman. But even then, I was very impressed by his ability to zero in on the harmonic identity of these bands. Even though the stuff he was doing wasn't particularly original, there was something that impressed me about the fact that he wrote something that sounded a lot like a Walkman song. Because that's not something that anybody can just do. In the meantime,